In 2012, California and Texas accounted for more than one-third of all farm workers, and 45% classified themselves as Hispanic. While they're largely unseen by the public, these laborers work in very hot weather with few amenities and no protections against abusive employment practices. And for all their hard labor, most take home $25 a day. In an article called The Forgotten Village, Revisiting Steinbeck's California, Gabriel Thompson, a reporter with the Nation Institute's Investigative Fund, looks into the conditions of migrant farm laborers today. It's in the summer issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review, and it brings Mr. Thompson to our show now. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You write that John Steinbeck would recognize the conditions of these farm laborers as being unchanged from what he described in his classic 1939 novel. Has nothing improved?
No, I think, he would see much that he would recognize, and of course, touring the state, he would find a state that had been completely transformed. One of the things that I was intrigued about when I encountered the Grapes of Wrath, not when it was assigned to me in high school. I kind of put it aside. It looked way too big. Steinbeck himself called it his 4-pound book. But I read it as an adult, which I think is an interesting way to encounter classics. You know, you have your brain's a little, at least my brain was a little more open than it was in high school. And so much has changed in terms of the population of the state. Obviously, from 1939 to today, California, you know, many technological revolutions, the populations have exploded. But I think that, you know, there would be enough there that he would see things that he certainly recognized. For one thing, you know, the book was published in 1939, and in 1936, he had actually had this bakery truck that he converted into a camper, and he had gone along. Can you hold on just one second?
Sure.
Sorry about this.
Live radio, folks. We're talking about an article called The Forgotten Village, Revisiting Steinbeck's California with Gabriel Thompson, who has published
that.
An article in the Virginia Quarterly Review. So he packed up this truck and went to live in the communities and then wrote about it for The Nation.
Yeah, he wrote about it for The Nation. He wrote about it as well for another San Francisco paper. And, you know, when The Grapes of Wrath came out, he was highly criticized for sort of inventing facts and not knowing what he was talking about.
Wasn't he accused of being a communist?
Oh, yeah, a communist. That would dog him throughout his life. I don't think he was particularly concerned about that. But what I was really intrigued by was that, so he packs up this truck and visits labor camps and fields, and originally it's going to be a sort of a reporting trip, but what he sees, you know, he visits a shanty town where a shanty collection of cardboard boxes, and kids are dying of malnutrition, and families are taking refuge under rolled-up carpets. And he's so, you know, his anger is so palpable, but he's also kind of so moved by what he sees that he ditches his notebook and starts trying to rescue families. And as he writes to one of his friends in a letter after returning from one of these sort of harrowing trips in which there had been, 2 weeks of intense flooding, that he kept at it until he sort of collapsed in the mud from exhaustion.
And the intense flooding provides him with the final chapters of The Grapes of Wrath, where we have an almost biblical flood.
That's right. I mean, I think when you read sort of his letters and journals and understand how he encountered what he had seen as a reporter, and he just took, you know, reams and reams of notes, and he also one of the key settings for the book, and I don't know how well your listeners remember it, but the Grapes of Wrath.
They saw the movie.
Okay, there you go, the movie. You know, the Joads encounter one hardship after another until they finally arrive in this migrant camp south of Bakersfield in the San Joaquin Valley. And there, their luck finally begins to change. They've been chased out. Their squatter camp has been burned to the ground. The deputy sheriff has attacked some of the workers. And they arrive at this camp, which Steinbeck calls Weed Patch. And it's sort of like a utopia. The workers, it's been built by the federal government to provide housing for these Dust Bowl migrants. The workers run the show, more or less. Cops aren't allowed in without a warrant. And it was a real attempt to sort of build a sense of community and solidarity among these families that whose lives had been completely dislocated, and a chance to sort of, you know, help get, you know, slip back into mainstream society as much as possible. What really intrigued me when I was reading about this camp was to realize that it wasn't a figment of his imagination, that that camp really existed, that that's where he went to learn about the migrant problem. And, you know, even more kind of unbelievable for me is that that camp still exists today. It's been running more or less consistently, except now, of course, the workers are almost exclusively Mexican immigrants that show up each summer to harvest the grapes of the region.
Now, the Jodes were from the Dust Bowl. Today, the Jodes would have been from some part of Mexico?
Yeah, I think that's right. And in this camp has about 88 units. I spent a fair amount of time just hanging out with people and talking with them and then going out in the fields with them. And the similarities are interesting. I mean, a lot of them, especially this one man I focused on in particular with the sort of melodious name of Timoteo Bello, he came from Puebla. And Puebla is part of this Mixteca region, which is very dry. And a number of people I interviewed left that region in the early 80s because of drought, because their land was not producing what they needed to produce. So you see, these echoes of the Jodes even today.
Well, Timoteo came to the United States from Mexico in 1984. Was he a farmer back there?
In Mexico?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was. So it was sort of subsistence farming. It was the kind of farming I think that the Jodes were doing in Oklahoma. Kind of, you know, you grow for yourself in a small farm. You have your own land. You grow, if you're lucky, to sell some products to make ends meet. And when he came to the U.S., he also had the kind of dream that the Jodes had, which was he wanted to own land. You know, he wanted to have his own place. The Jodes leave Oklahoma, and they, you know, they've got, of course, these grand visions of what California will be like, as I think California still sort of functions that way in many people's minds, of where you can let go of your problems and there's beautiful oceans and the coast. And for the Jodes, it was that work would be abundant, but not only that, but that the work would be almost sublime. You know, they would be able to work under harvest, you know, pick oranges under the groves, and when they got tired, they could relax and sleep in the shade of the tree and eat oranges. And Grandpa Jode, who unfortunately dies en route to California, imagines filling a bathtub full of grapes and just kind of sliming around it and, like, having the juice fall over him. Of course, you know, that's not what they find when they arrive in California. And
they're chased by vigilantes.
They find vigilantes. They also find, yeah, that the work is not plentiful.
And they have ruthless growers to deal with.
They've got growers to deal with. It pays poorly. And I think even sort of on a deeper level, on a deep level, they have to abandon the idea that they could ever own their own little property and do what they did back then. They join a huge sort of migrant army of people that shuffle back and forth from place to place. Welcome for the brief moments when the crop needs to be harvested, and then treated like vagrants and forced out when the crop has been harvested.
In fact, he says they're urged to go with guns.
Yes, yeah, that's what Steinbeck says for his the first piece he really writes is for the Nation, and then he follows up with a longer piece for San Francisco paper. But yeah, there's you're being you're basically being acted upon by forces of which you have no control.
Now, you
and,
say
I mean,
that...
The Jodes,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the Jodes, I think, like anyone else and like farm workers today and anyone tries to some measure sort of maintain their dignity and take steps to sort of assert their humanity and their ability to impact their lives. But, you know, they are small people being moved by forces that they don't always understand. And even if they understand them, they're often powerless to do anything about them.
Tim Mateo was married with four children when he came here. Could he bring them with them?
When he came here, he originally came, both he and his wife, I think, came as undocumented. He got on a raft and got across the Rio Grande and into Texas, left the kids there, had dreams of making it big. People had come back to his small village driving nice cars and with all sorts of, mostly probably, I guess, tall tales about how much easier it was up there. He worked, he lived in about 10 people in an apartment in Houston, did construction, made $3 or $4 an hour, returned, realizing it wasn't quite what he had hoped. But then when he does return with his wife later on to start working in the grapes, they are lucky enough to become legal residents through Immigration Reform Act in 86. And then they petition to have their kids come. And that's a real help because not only, you know, are they all living together, but the kids are old enough now at 15 and 16 to start working in the grapes with them. And so, you know, one of the things that's very unchanged between today and back in 1939 when the book came out is that migrant farm workers make just about as much to continue being migrant farm workers. You know, you're moving back and forth, and you can get by as long as you don't have any of the sorts of emergencies that come up in every person's life regularly. And then you have, you know, kind of crisis moments.
Now, you say he picks grapes. Are we talking about table grapes or wine grapes?
We're talking about table grapes, yeah.
Now, he came here to escape a drought. There's a drought in California now. Is that ironic? Are people being forced to leave the state because there are fewer crops?
You know, the drought situation is complicated in terms of how it affects farm workers. On the one hand, about 500,000 acres have been left fallow this year, which is, to give you a sense, that's about the size of Los Angeles and San Diego combined. So that's a huge amount of land that's not being cultivated. And there were estimates that upwards maybe 17,000 jobs would be lost from farm workers. Half of that came true. The prediction that came true, the land is fallow. There's about 500,000. But most of the fallow land is rice and wheat and crops that don't need that much labor to harvest. And so, in fact, just recently, the state came out with data showing that about 6,000 new farm worker jobs were added, despite the drought. And that's because there's been a shift to more labor-intensive crops, berries, table grapes, especially in Kern County, where I was reporting, are exploding. I mean, in Kern County alone, you've got, I think, about 100,000 acres are being grown for grapes, which is more than three times the size of San Francisco, of just grapes being grown. So there is still... What happens in the future is unclear. I mean, if this keeps going, it's going to definitely start affecting farm workers more. And I think there's a sense of, at least with the, you know, I went out with crews, foremen telling me they've been doing grapes for four decades. They've never seen a drought like this. And there's this kind of unease about the future, about what might happen if it continues like this.
Mike, I'm talking with Gabe Thompson, a reporter with the Nation Institute's Investigative Fund, and he's written an article for the Virginia Quarterly Review, the summer edition of that magazine, called The Forgotten Village, Revisiting Steinbeck's California. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Mm-hmm. And we are back with Gabe Thompson, whose article, The Forgotten Village, Revisiting Steinbeck's California, is in the summer edition of the Virginia Quarterly Review. And we should note that Steinbeck won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. But as you point out, at the time, Kern County banned the book, and several growers even burned it. It obviously touched a nerve. You think they would do that today?
I mean, I think they would be a little more savvy today and realize that burning books, you know, while the Nazis are in power, is probably not the smartest thing to be doing.
Although I hear they're burning copies of the Virginia Quarterly Review.
I'm sure in terms from a PR perspective, that would be wonderful for Virginia Quarterly, because that would make it a front page story in a lot of places. I somehow doubt that. But I think what was interesting, you know, there's a sense that... And I brought a little bit of this sense to the piece, which was that, yes, farm workers have it very hard, and yes, they're exploited, and they've been exploited for so long, and it's just kind of the way things are. And so why would we be surprised? When you look back at the history of agriculture in California and farm workers, you see that there are these moments in which there really seemed like major progress was possible and actually was happening. You know, Steinbeck's book was lambasted. They had people trying to create. They created this movie called Plums of Plenty to show that in fact everything that Steinbeck wrote was wrong. That it was just this paradise for people like the Jodes. But what also happened was that the book generated an incredible amount of sympathy and a sense of urgency that something had to be done. And so, you know, farm worker organizers used that book in some way to call for a strike of that fall, the same year that the book came out. Hollywood folks came in and donated money, and there was a sense that there was something was going to happen, and a lot of workers walked out on strike. Unfortunately, what happened there, in large measure, is that it was crushed by brute force by growers and sort of people that were helping growers wading into labor union rallies with swinging chains and tire axes and beating the crap out of people. But there was, I think, there are these moments in which you see that there's potential for something. I would say, too, with the Grapes of Wrath, it was a real unique moment that Steinbeck documented.
But then later we have Cesar Chavez, and we have the United Farm Workers strikes of the late 60s into 1970. Didn't they improve things?
Oh, they certainly did. I think wages were going up, all these things that you would think that you don't typically associate with farm workers, benefits, pensions, health care. Probably even almost most importantly is this idea, you know, you can't have a labor agency that's looking farm, you know, if farm workers are working in many areas of the state, and they're often in remote areas, and you simply can't have the government there enforcing labor laws all the time. But what the UFW, United Farm Workers, was able to do was to actually get growers to pay to have certain worker union members, their only job was to go around enforcing the contract. So they're there in the fields. If they see someone's not getting paid, well, if they see there's some sort of sexual harassment, they file charges right away. It gets resolved. So you suddenly have this mechanism in which workers themselves are really the strength of it. They're really the enforcers. For several decades, a real force in the fields. Partly, it also helped that, Cesar Chavez is one of his great geniuses, was farm workers have had a hard time organizing for a long time because they've been so isolated. And growers have kind of worked to keep them isolated. At times, reporters will show up at labor actions and, you know, growers will literally escort them away with sheriffs so that they can't report on what's happening. But the United Farm Workers were able to connect the fight in the fields with the consumers who were buying their products. And if there's not that much movement in the fields now, you know, even in a time when we've got fast food workers moving, and we've got things that seemed unthinkable, like a $15 minimum wage, suddenly seeming like, oh, that could be doable. There's not a movement right now to organize California farm workers with that sort of vigor. But
well, Bayo only earns, he says, around $15,000 a year. That's way below minimum wage for somebody who works from sunrise to sunset.
It's most farm workers earn. There's rampant wage theft. Bayo is one of the more stable workers in that he's been working at this same company for a while. But yeah, you're at about $9-$10 an hour. If you're being paid legally, sometimes $11 an hour. But that's the kind of existence that if even the most minor emergency happens, you're suddenly you're in big trouble.
He once had a job planting pine trees in Oregon for $12 an hour. That's not a lot of money, but that's a lot better. Why couldn't he just continue doing that?
Yeah, well, his family was in Coachella, which Coachella is, it's where the grape harvest begins. It's near Palm Springs, but it's not at all like Palm Springs. It's poor and farm workers, and there's no glitz there. So his family was living there, and he would go up to Oregon for months at a time and live in campers and sort of scramble up hills and plant trees. But, he wanted to live with his family. You know, he's got kids, he's got a wife. You can do that for a little bit, but as you start getting older, I think you have to start making, decisions about what family for him is like for many of us. It's the most important thing we've got going. And so from an economic perspective, it might have made sense, but from a human perspective, he didn't want to keep doing it.
If these people keep on moving around, working one place and then another, what is housing like for them?
Oh, it's a complete struggle. I mean, there's one study I was looking at of a number of communities in California, farm worker communities, that found that about 1 out of 10 farm workers were living in what researchers called informal dwellings, which is garages, sheds, barns, abandoned vehicles, because people sort of descend on a community during harvest time. That sends rents through the roof, right? Because suddenly there's way too many people for units. And so California has never found a way to house its migrant farm workers. And that was back in 1936, that was John Steinbeck's assignment, was to go out and see how the Dust Bowl migrants were living and the horrendous housing conditions. That's been something that's been going on forever. And the state and feds provide, I think, somewhere about maybe 7,500 units set aside for farm workers. In California, there's an estimated perhaps 800,000 farm workers in California. So that's less than 1% of the workforce. And, if you say that more than half of the California farm workers are undocumented, they don't actually have access to that housing anyway. So housing is a key problem.
And according to a 2014 report published by Don Villarejo, the founder of the California Institute for Rural Studies, 1 in 5 California growers claimed to provide housing for seasonal employees in 1986. By 2012, only 3.6% said that they did.
Yeah, and
that's hardly anyone.
Hardly anyone. And the backstory to that is why they all got out of it. Most of them. It's not as simple as it just deciding to go. It's that when OSHA, when the agency started looking and seeing what are the conditions of the housing camps, they were atrocious. They shut them down. There has been a dwindling of supply, but partly that dwindling of supply is because once people realize, and I've been in awful labor camps in places like North Carolina, they're shutting down. They're getting out of the business because now they're being asked to actually provide housing that, they would want potentially their own children to be living in.
Now, where did the migrant workers move from and to during the harvest season? First of all, where do they move when the harvest is over? Do they find another harvest in another part of the country?
Not so so much. I mean, most, especially following the grapes in California, they move between two different valleys, the Coachella Valley, which is it's where the season begins. It's incredibly hot. Begins in the winter, so January, and then by summertime they move to the San Joaquin Valley, and they kind of go back and forth. And occasionally people will go to another place to harvest strawberries for a while or cherries for a while, but the dedicated grape workers mostly move between those two valleys.
And
I would say that there's actually less migration going on now than there was in the past, and partly I think that's because when you migrate, there are some more year-round crops, but also when you migrate, especially if you're undocumented, you put everyone in the car and you start driving across the state, it's risky. You could come across a Border Patrol checkpoint. You could get pulled over. And so I think people are staying put a little more just because the trip is could end in sort of the family being dislocated.
Now, California is generally considered one of the more liberal states, and San Francisco has already raised the minimum wage. I think a couple of other cities have considered it. Why do we have these kinds of conditions in that state?
Well, I mean, so it's complicated. I think part of it has to be, and it's not a happy story, but that the UFW, the United Farm Workers, really stopped large part organizing farm workers in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, mostly early 80s. And so there's not a force out there that is actively engaging to organize farm workers, because I think that's going to be kind of the answer. I mean, why is fast food? I was actually working at a union when we were first thinking about fast food workers, and there was a lot of resistance. Like, well, fast food workers, that seems like, you know, that just can't happen. And a $15 minimum wage, like, that seems like asking for the moon. And then when people start moving and getting into action, you start engaging people, what seems impossible starts to seem like, oh, yeah, that's the next inevitable step. They don't have that sort of infrastructure of organizing farm workers right now in California. And I think that's a big problem of it. And enforcement helps too. But I think if you had sort of workers in motion and you had consumers that, and there are reasons for optimism. Like, people obsess about where their food is coming at farmers markets, and they want to know the grower and want to know all these things that use pesticides. It's one step more to say, well, I want to go buy produce that's being harvested by a farm worker that's making a living wage. Well, it's hard to do that right now because it just kind of, there's not very many people doing that. But I think as those questions start coming up and as people start thinking more about that, I don't want to be like Pollyannish, but I think those are steps that would be in the right direction.
Gabriel Thompson's article, The Forgotten Village, Revisiting Steinbeck's California, is in the summer edition of the Virginia Quarterly Review. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Oh, thanks for having me.